It's 2:59 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau, the Alaska capital city. It's time for another edition of A Juneau Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. And on the show, we'll be talking with Andrea Thomas from Search about some upcoming health insurance workshops. As part of our Tuesday series about Juneau's government services, we'll profile the City and Borough of Juneau Public Works Department. Mari New will be here to highlight her work with Moscow's Bolshoi Ballet, and new Student Services Director Bridget Weiss will be here to talk about back-to-school immunizations. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and some more for Tuesday, August 12, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Along the Columbia River this month, a prayer vigil is being held to focus on the Columbia River Treaty. Steve Jackson has more.
The Columbia River Treaty between the U.S. and Canada has been in effect since 1964. It put into place a mechanism for the two countries to reduce flooding and increase electrical power generation. But it did not address the status of salmon and steelhead that have been decimated by the dams on the giant waterway. The two nations are looking at renegotiating that treaty. Now Native American tribes say the negotiations need to consider fish and climate change, and they're holding a prayer vigil all along the river in an effort to make that happen. Matt Wynn is the chairman of the Upper Columbia United Tribes.
I pray every day, not only for the river and for my family, but for all people, you know. So I think that it's kind of a holistic approach. Actually, a major part of the prayer vigil is talking about returning the salmon home. And that's really key to us since we haven't had them since before 1939.
Churches from many denominations have been invited to take part. The event began earlier in the month in Astoria, Oregon, and is being held all along the Columbia River with several tribes participating. The final event will be August the 16th in British Columbia. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
In Alaska, a woman named Linda Green, a professor from Arizona, is alleging police brutality in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Green points to an incident she witnessed in Bethel during the arrest of a citizen. City leaders tell radio station KYUK they're investigating. Daisha Eaton reports.
Green says the officer and the man spoke briefly, then the officer jumped out of the car, grabbed the man's arm and flipped him face down onto the pavement and tried to handcuff him.
So he picks the man up horizontally from his backpack and his waistband about 3 feet in the air and slams him down, puts his knee back on his back, again tries to twist those arms around, unable to do so. 3 more times he picks that man up and slams him down into the ground.
She took her complaint to the police chief, to the city manager, and to the mayor. She filed a statement with the police department, told her story to KYUK, and published a letter to the editor in the local newspaper. A police report says an officer by the name of Andrew Reed observed Wassily Gregory, an Indian male, at 9:18 a.m. as, quote, clearly intoxicated. The report says that Gregory made verbal threats to Reed and challenged him to a fight, and that Reed was afraid that he might be grabbing for a weapon. 48-year-old Gregory appeared in court on July 14th. The charges of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest were dropped, but he pleaded guilty as part of a plea deal to harassment to offensive physical contact. Green filed her statement with the Bethel Police Department on the same day she witnessed the incident, 2 days before Gregory took the plea deal. Being intoxicated in public is not a crime in Alaska. Officer Reed was contacted for this story but did not return phone calls or emails. Green said she came to KYUK because nobody from the city would get back to her.
At the very least, I thought at the very least that the people in authority would want to talk to me. And no one seems to want to talk to me.
Bethel City officials eventually told Green that they were conducting an investigation. KYUK contacted Bethel City officials for this story. They say they will not comment about an ongoing investigation. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Native Women's Association of Canada, the Assembly of First Nations, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have teamed up on an awareness campaign. 3 posters have been released that focus on preventing family violence and raise awareness about timely reporting of missing persons. The campaign is part of efforts to address missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered. Cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kawanic Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And Juno Afternoon continues. My first guest today is Andrea Thomas from the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, and I'd like to welcome her to the show.
Hello, Jeff. It's great to be here.
All right. And you're here to host two free presentations in Juno that are going to take place tonight, right?
Right. The first one is tonight from 5:30 to 6:30 at the Juno Public Library right downtown. And on Thursday, it's going to be from noon to 1 at the Valley Public Library. I'm also doing one other presentation at the Healthy Choice Conference at the Elizabeth Paradovich Building from 2 to 3. That one's focused on Alaska more for Alaska Natives.
I'm sure a lot of people have questions still about health insurance coverage, so why don't you give a little bit of information about what the presentation will contain?
Okay, great. Well, I'll be answering lots of questions about the Affordable Care Act and the health insurance marketplace because it is extremely confusing, and part of it is that it's a huge piece of legislation. In fact, the brief, the summary, is 900 pages long and not easy reading. So it is a lot about insurance reform. So some of the things that people have heard about is that the health insurance companies can't deny people coverage for pre-existing conditions. So, for example, if you hurt your back when you were 18 years old, they can't say, I'm not covering that when you're 30. Another reform is that they can't charge some people more than other people. So they can't charge women more than men because they have babies. They can't have lifetime limits of insurance. In other words, if you're a child and you have leukemia when you're young, if with a lifetime insurance, you could run out of your insurance when you're little and not be covered for the rest of your life. And that has been made illegal. So those are just a few of the very many changes being made. Most people think about the health insurance marketplace and Affordable Care Act is the individual mandate to have insurance. So either you need to have insurance, you need to pay a fine, pay a tax penalty, or get an exemption from paying the fine.
Okay, why don't we go over a little of that in detail, because I know everybody was supposed to have been signed up by March 31st.
Right.
How did that work in Alaska? Do we have any figures?
We have about 12,000 people signed up, so we have a whole lot more people
than I would have expected it was a lot more than that.
Yeah, so it's a little tricky because there wasn't very much information about it, and so the next open enrollment is in November, but for now, if people do not have insurance, there's a couple of possibilities to sign up for the health insurance marketplace. If you have lost your insurance by changing jobs or getting a divorce or, you know, any number of things happening, there's a special enrollment period for people. So that's still a possibility. If you don't have insurance, there's a number of different things you can do. You might be eligible for Medicaid if you have a family with young children. You also, if you're 65, you might be eligible for Medicare. If you're a veteran, you're eligible for veterans benefits. And you can also purchase public, you know, private insurance. That's another way to go because the fine is levied for the number of months that you don't have insurance. Now, the fine for not having insurance is $95 for an adult or half that for a child or 1% of your income, whichever is greater. So it could be a very large fee, and where you're going to be seeing that is when April rolls around and you're filing your taxes. Now, this is the tricky thing. If you don't enroll for insurance, if you don't get insurance that starts January 1st, the next year it's going to be even higher.
Okay, I know a lot of people are looking at it and saying, well, it's only $95. I can afford that, and they just skip it for this year. And there are people that are probably doing just that. Mm-hmm. But I know we talked a little about this before we went on the air, but let's go over how the fines start escalating.
Right.
Because that doesn't stay at just the cheap 95 or 1% rate for very long.
Right. Well, 1% of your income can be a pretty
1%
large
of your
sum.
Gross, yeah.
Right. Right. And there's a cap to that. So if the cap is $3,600 per person. So the following year, it jumps up to $325 per person and half that, or 2% of your income. So it more than doubles in terms of dollar amount and doubles when you're talking about the percentage of your income. So that's a pretty big incentive to get some insurance. Now, most people want to get insurance, and that it just doesn't seem affordable. And I think what people don't understand is that the health insurance marketplace is set up to assist people with certain income levels to make lower premiums and lower out-of-pocket expenses. So it's set up for people that make 100% to 400% federal poverty level. Well, what's that? So if you're a single person and you make between $14,350 and $57,400, you're going to be probably eligible for a lower monthly premium and also less out of the pocket. So what does less out of the pocket mean? So usually when you have insurance, you pay a monthly premium, and that can be lower. And then you have to pay your deductible. So let's just say $500. You have to pay $500 out of your pocket before insurance kicks in. Then when insurance kicks in, you have a copay or coinsurance, and that, so the insurance company pays 80%, you pay 20%. And then there's a maximum out-of-pocket, and that's new in the law, that anybody, as a part of the law, will not pay more than $6,350 in any year for insurance. And that's a new part of the law, too. So I think people get scared away because it's so confusing and it's hard to understand. And people are actually really missing out on a great opportunity to get insurance.
Okay, what kind of is it just catastrophic, or what all can be covered by these plans? And are there some a la carte type items that people can get where it's not all inclusive, or do they have any choices in this?
Well, every state is a little bit different. For Alaska, there's two insurance companies, MOTA and Blue Cross Blue Shield. And within that, there's a number of different plans to choose from. But all of them are required to do the 10 essential benefits, which are ambulatory services, emergency services, hospitalization, maternity and newborn care, mental health services, and that includes behavioral health and substance abuse treatment, prescription drugs, rehabilitative services like physical therapy, laboratory services, and preventative and wellness. Those are all 100% free. In other words, if you go in for cancer screening or your women's yearly checkup or immunizations, those actually are free. They're not part of the deductible. And also pediatric services. Now, the couple things that aren't covered for adults are dental and vision. You can choose a plan that's more expensive that has vision and hearing, but in general, you would have to buy a separate dental plan.
There's not very many good plans that have that anyway.
Yeah, I know it.
There may be some for some state workers, mm-hmm. but that really dental and vision coverage usually is what a lot of people skip, and then it winds up becoming an out-of-pocket expense.
Right. So another thing to keep in mind is that if you fall below the 100% poverty level, so for example, if I'm a single person and I make less than $14,350, you fall in what's considered the gap. How the health insurance marketplace was set up is that it was to help people between 100% and 400% get insurance. So people below that, the federal government was going to give states money to expand Medicaid. Now, our governor chose not to accept that money. So we have a group of people in Alaska, and how many is people fight over. Kaiser Foundation says we have at least 26,000. The state of Alaska says 10 to 12,000. And those people essentially have no insurance coverage. And in addition to that, they need to file an affordability exemption so they don't get a fine for not having insurance. So I can help with that too. And that's a little bit tricky. And I've just this past week, I've had to work with six people that had to file these exemptions.
Okay, now these exemptions, this comes about because it working for wages, you're not bringing in this amount or more in money.
That's right.
How do they look at it if you've got other assets? And they say, well, you've got money in the bank, so we're not going to give you any assistance. Do they do that, or does that not figure into anything at all? Is it just working for wages that counts?
Adjusted gross income, but it can be Social Security also. It's not just necessarily working wages, right? It's the income coming in. That's what they look at. They don't look at how, you know, your house, or they don't look at how much money you have in the bank.
Okay, so this could be pension income, or this could be Social Security income that also comes in. What about somebody's investment income or inheritance? How does that figure in? Does that figure in at all?
Well, it's all based on your taxes. So when you file your taxes, it's your adjusted gross income, and that's the number that they use.
Okay.
So it's what your income minus your deductibles.
Well, so, that was a bit just clarifying that part, not to mention all the different things that are involved in the law and the different coverages that are out there.
Yes, it is.
It's mind-numbing.
It's really confusing, and that's why I really encourage people to come to the presentations. And also, while I'm here, people feel free to give my cell phone a call. That's my work cell phone. It's 752-3336. I'm here assisting people enroll in the health insurance marketplace, and I can actually help people. I'm in Sitka, but I can help people in Juneau enroll because I've gone through the training, and I'm a certified application counselor.
Andrea, are there other people that are doing this across the state to assist people in getting organized and on the healthcare system?
Yes. In fact, there's a whole team of us that are working on this, and I'm part of a whole statewide team. And hopefully people will, once open enrollment for the next year is going to start November 15th and go to February 15th. So those of you out there that already have insurance through the marketplace, there's going to be a window of time, November 15th to December 15th, to take a look at your plan and see if you want to change it. And that's the window of time to change that. And it's also time for anybody who doesn't have insurance to start enrolling and go through the process. And you can call the national number, and I should have that with me. I'll grab that.
That's okay.
But that is that's a toll-free number, and they're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's 1-800-318-2596. And again, that's 24 hours, 7 days a week, and you can enroll completely over the phone. What you'll want to have with you is your what you think you're going to make in 2015, but right now for helping people this year, it's 2014. And you'll want to have everybody's Social Security number, birth dates, and all that kind of information.
Now, we've heard about other states' websites crashing, you know, that people were trying to get on in different areas of the country. Mm-hmm. Has Alaska experienced any of that?
Well, Alaska is using the federal health insurance marketplace. So some places have their own, and we're using the federal one because we didn't start our own. And so it's actually the website has been working pretty darn well lately, and they're actually going to make a number of changes, so it just keeps getting better. And so I know a number of people were really frustrated last year, and so this next year, just like any new project, there's always bugs to work out, and I think next year is going to be much, much smoother.
Andrea, in closing, could you remind everybody when these presentation workshops are? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are just clueless as to how to get started, and they need a little bit of direction. So I know you've got the workshops coming up. Please remind everybody where they're going to be held and when, because one's tonight.
One is tonight, and it's at the Juneau Public Library downtown, and it's from 5:30 to 6:30. Then tomorrow, Wednesday, from 2 to 3, I'll be at the Healthy Choices Conference, and that's at the Elizabeth Paradovich Building. And that will primarily be focused on Alaska Native and the health insurance marketplace. So that's if that's of interest to you. And then on Thursday from noon to 1, I'll be at the Valley Public Library and doing a presentation about the health insurance marketplace and the Affordable Care Act.
Andrea Thomas from Search, thank you very much for being our first guest on the show today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 12th of August, 2014. It was on this date, 1851, Isaac Merritt Singer patented his first commercial sewing machine. He didn't invent the machine. He just made it more practical and efficient. His was the first to use an up-and-down needle movement instead of sideways, and it was powered by a foot treadle. And because Singer's sewing machine was a little bit expensive, he pioneered something else as well, the idea of buying on credit and making installment payments. It's the birthday of the filmmaker Cecil B. DeMille, born Asheville, Massachusetts, 1881, made 70 movies between 1914 and 1956. He was known for lavish spectacles with the casts of thousands. His first was Joan the Woman, 1916, about Joan of Arc. 1923, he did The Ten Commandments, and then remade The Ten Commandments in 1956. And while he was filming on location in Egypt, Cecil B. DeMille had a massive heart attack. He rested for a week, and against his doctor's orders, he went back to work. He managed to finish the film, but it was his last, and he died in 1959. It's the birthday of the poet Robert Southey, born in Bristol, 1774. He was a member of the Romantic movement, one of the Lake poets in England, poet laureate for a time. He was a great rival of Lord Byron, who wrote parodies of Southey's poems, and Southey made fun of Byron, referred to him and his friends as the Satanic School of Poetry. Today we know Robert Southey for a couple of little things. He was the first to write down the fairy tale, The Three Bears, back in 1837, and he wrote the nursery rhyme, What Are Little Boys Made Of? And today is the birthday of Zerna Sharp, born in Hillsburg, Indiana, 1889. She was an elementary school teacher who created the Dick and Jane books for beginning readers. She was concerned about literacy. She felt the children would be more receptive to reading if the stories were about kids they could relate to. So in 1927, she came up with the idea of a young brother and sister, Dick and Jane, and she added their mother and father and their little sister, Sally, and Spot, the dog, and Puff, the cat, and wrote stories, simple stories in short, repetitive sentences. Run, Spot, run. Funny, funny Spot. Look, Dick, look, Jane. Books that entered the classrooms in 1930 and were routinely used until the late 1960s. Here's a poem for today by Barbara Crooker entitled The 50s. We spent those stifling, endless summer afternoons on hot front porches, cutting paper dolls from Sears catalogs, making up our own ideal families, complete with large appliances and an all-occasion wardrobe with fold-down paper tabs. Sometimes we left crayons on the cement landing just to watch them melt. We followed the shade around the house. Time was a jar full of pennies, too hot to spend, stretching long and sticky, a break of Bonomo's Turkish taffy. Tomorrow would be more of the same, ending with softball or kickball, then hide and seek in the mosquito-y dark. fireflies like connect the dots, or find the hidden words, rose and glowed, winked on and off, their cool fires, coded signals of longing and love, that we would one day learn to speak. The 50s by Barbara Cooker from her collection Radiance, published by Word Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Alaska's primary election is fast approaching. Join us on Wednesday evening, August 13th, to hear from candidates seeking the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. That's Debate for the State, live Wednesday, August 13th at 7 p.m., right here on your local APRN station.
As a pregnant mom and someone who helps people quit tobacco, I have an important tip for moms and dads who are pregnant or might get pregnant and smoke. Quit smoking. Smoking can cause premature birth and increases your baby's risk for developmental delays, problems with eyesight, breathing, and more. You can quit. Talk with your doctor or call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line for free help at 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Brought to you by Search and the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast.
3:25 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. And my next guest is part of our Tuesday service series about Juneau's government, and this is the City and Borough of Juneau Public Works Department. So I'd like to welcome Samantha Stoutinger, who is the wastewater superintendent.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, nice to have you on the show, Samantha. All right, the City Borough of Juneau Public Works Department, what areas does the Public Works Department cover?
Well, CBJ Public Works has several different divisions. One component is Capital Transit, obviously. Second is Streets and Fleet. Third is Water. Fourth would be Wastewater. And, of course, then we have Household Hazardous Waste. So we run a pretty big gamut of CBJ services.
All right. And what does a wastewater superintendent do? So I'm asking you specifically about your job.
So I am tasked with overseeing the treatment and collection of all of the wastewater for all of Juneau and Douglas areas. So essentially my team collects and maintains all of the manholes that you see and all the pipes in the ground and that you don't, in addition to the 45 lift stations that we have throughout the facilities, and then conveying that to our one of three treatment plants. So any day I can be doing a variety of different things, but my team, we work to treat that water and then discharge the treated effluent to our disposal locations and or haul off the solid product, which currently goes down south for disposal. So.
Oh, so those barges don't go back empty.
They come back up empty, but they go down full. Yeah, that's true. Our containers do go down with the solid waste product and for disposal down in Oregon.
And the other divisions that work in Public Works Department, let's talk about road repair, because there's been a lot of that this summer.
Sure, yeah. The Streets Department, they are very busy working on a multitude of different projects, and in fact, they will even coordinate with either the water or the wastewater utility in trying to consolidate projects to do repairs that may be going on, whether it's with CBJ and or the state. So they are extremely busy, and then that doesn't lull much because once the snow flies, they also are responsible for clearing all the snow and the sidewalks, and that is definitely something we want to keep open in mind for the citizens, is to try to get all of your parked goods, whether it be boats, vehicles, off the right-of-way during the winter so that, you know, our guys can actually get to the roads to clear them off.
I noticed that quite a bit of guardrail is being removed and replaced. Do you know anything about that project?
No,
not. It's going on all over North Douglas specifically, and then quite a bit on Egan Highway, too.
Actually, I am not familiar with those projects, but I do know that the state has got quite a few projects going on, so it may not even be a CBJ project. It may actually be a state project, depending on which road it's on.
Okay, and how do you interface with the state? Do they tell you what's coming up and then you got to coordinate everything together? Because I can just imagine somebody saying, well, we're going to do this, and you know, one of our departments here in the borough says, wait a minute, we've got this going on, and how do you get together to resolve the conflicts, and how much notice do you get ahead of time when something is coming up that the state is doing?
Well, the state has actually a pretty good list of projects that they want to do out in quite a bit of time. We also have a list of our own improvements, whether it be from a utility perspective or from a street perspective. And so we try to stay in contact with the engineers and planners at the state to figure out what funding might be coming available, what funding may work for us in timing and scheduling and whatnot. And then obviously we have to try to be flexible because we don't want to have the state repair a road and then have our improvements, for example, a utility that needs to be put in.
We'll rip it up again.
Exactly. That is definitely not the route that we like to go. So, you know, it is a lot of coordination, and I have to say, you know, engineering department does a lot of that coordination with for us in helping to get on board with exactly where the state is in their programming, and they help Public Works to kind of push those projects forward and making sure that it all goes smoothly. And then during the construction project, our teams, whether it be the utilities or streets department, as well as engineering, stays in the loop. So, for example, the Occupy Roundabout, I know that pretty much all of the divisions that have interest there are in tune in what's going on, and there's a good rapport within the CBJ itself and then working with the state to try to get the best product that we can for all of the citizens.
And does some of that funding that the state has trickle down to you at the borough level? Who exactly pays for this, and how does that flow of money go for projects?
There is a variety of funding for different projects. If there is something that, for example, may be grant eligible, we will put in for those type of applications. We also do apply for loans. And depending the need, if there's something located in the right-of-way, the state may actually be able to write it into one of their projects to relocate something, you know, if it's, for example, a structure that needs to be relocated for a safety issue. So it's just really a gamut. It's also obviously taxpayer funds. It could be utility rate funds. So it just comes from a variety of different areas. And you know, obviously, these projects are not cheap, so, you know, trying to utilize all the funds in the best regard that we can is really important for us.
All right, Samantha, so we went through wastewater and we went through construction. What other things is the Public Works Department responsible for covering?
So, obviously, one of our big service areas is Capital Transit.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about bus service.
Yeah, and that's one area where I'm not involved a lot with because they don't actually do a lot of construction and they aren't in, you know, interface too much with the utilities. I do know that the facility plan or the comprehensive plan has been out there to essentially bring up to speed where our Capital Transit program works. And so I do know that obviously everyone sees the buses, and we are trying to maintain the best service that we can. And I think that it's a huge asset to Juneau, and you know, that is a big facet of what Public Works does.
And how is the ridership covering as far as, you know, like the total cost of Capital Transit? Are we running in the black or in the red? You're looking like you're going to laugh here.
Yeah, you're really talking to a utility person.
Okay. All right.
Unfortunately, I really don't know. I do know that we do have a really good turnout of ridership, and I think that's very positive. And I definitely think that's a perspective that a lot of Juneau citizens really take pride in, and I think it's really important.
Yeah, certainly between the valley and downtown, there's quite a bit of ridership.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Not quite as much out at the North Douglas end, but, you know, because I know that they had a midday service that they discontinued. They still have a morning and an evening service that they run, but I know they pulled the midday service out. Okay, what else is the I'm not going to stop you too much more.
Sure.
What else does the Public Works Department cover?
Sure. So water is obviously a large component of what else Public Works does, especially from a utilities perspective. We provide we treat the water and distribute it to all the citizens. And it is a very We're blessed with having very good water sources here, and I think I've heard that quite a bit around town. And
oh, this summer, I don't know who doesn't need it, because, I mean, we've been getting water coming out of the sky here for, like, pretty much the last 2 months.
Yeah, the we obviously do have some interesting facets of living here and dealing with some of our sources, but the quality is phenomenal, and I think that's one thing that the water utility team really does focus on in trying to maintain that and trying to operate the utilities as efficiently as possible, but maintaining that high level of quality.
Right. Would I be stumping you if I asked where the big water collection facility is so that you can tell everybody?
So we have obviously two sources. Salmon Creek is our surface water source, and then we also have a well source, which both sites are actually being worked on for improved capacity, which is being funded by different areas right now. So they're kind of hot topic areas that are interesting and moving forward in that utility.
Right. And how is capacity working out versus our population? We don't seem to be picking up a whole lot of additional people in Juneau. So where are we at capacity-wise, you know, as far as the systems go? We're not, like, overly strained, are we?
I think that's a tricky question. From the perspective of system modeling, we are obviously, you know, impacted by conditions that would reduce the supply that we have. I think that increasing the well capacities will improve our ability to service Juneau. There is a lot of good water available. We just have to be able to get it out of the ground. And I think that's the problem with the well system right now. And I know we're working on it, and that's very positive. I don't know what percent capacity we're actually operating at, so that I can't specifically tell you, but I do know that we are doing everything we can to provide what water we have to the citizens.
All right. Hopefully I didn't stump you with too much there. Samantha Stoutender from the Public Works Department, thank you very much for being my guest on the show today.
Thank you.
And now Mari New is going to be here to highlight her work with Moscow Bolshoi Ballet. So I'm going to run a little bit of Swan Lake Waltz, and hope you enjoy this one here. And we're going to be bringing Mari on in just a few moments. Okay, that was part of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake Ballet. That was actually pretty good. I don't get a lot of chance to listen to Tchaikovsky, but my next guest on the show today is Mari New, and she's here to highlight her work with Moscow's Bolshoi Ballet, and it's a pleasure to have her on the show with us.
Thank you. Mari. Hi. Dobry den.
All right. Well, that's a little bit of Russian. So everybody that was wondering what good afternoon sounds like, that's what it sounds like. So, Mari, tell us a little bit about your experience with the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow.
So I was spent 6 weeks there last summer with the National Security Language Initiative for Youth Program. It's a scholarship for 6 weeks sponsored by the U.S. Department of State, and they take 15 U.S. students there for 6 weeks, and we learn ballet and also Russian language and culture. And then at the end of that 6 weeks, they invited me and two other people to come back and train at the academy for the year.
Okay, so you're just one of a few that's been invited back.
From my group of 15 Americans, yes.
Okay, would you describe a little bit about the Russian culture? What has been, like, shocking to you, or what did you think of it over there?
Honestly, I really love it so much because ballet is so much a part of the culture there. You go to a performance on a Monday night and the house is totally packed and people are screaming bravo, and it's just really, it's so much a part of their culture. The children grow up and they learn about the ballet. You go on the street, there's Matryoshka dolls and they have ballerinas on them. It's just, it's very a loved part of their culture, and that's really nice to experience.
And how were you received over there? Did they, you know, welcome you with open arms? Did they really enjoy having you and the other Americans there?
They really did. It was such an amazing experience. And all the Russian teachers and many of the Russian students have been really kind to me. And they're very helpful when I don't know how to say something in Russian. They just kind of laugh and help me say it better and teach me. So it's been really, really nice. I'm really thankful that they were so welcoming.
Are they able to help you? Are you able to help them with English?
I am sometimes. There's a few.
And do they speak it quite a bit?
Not the teachers. All of our classes are in Russian, so you definitely need to know the language. And the dorm moms don't speak English, and really just some of the students speak a little English. But for the most part, you need to learn Russian as quickly as possible so you can learn as much.
Yeah, because it's hard to follow directions when you don't understand.
Definitely.
All right, and how did your interest in ballet come about?
I actually didn't start ballet until I was 12 years old, considered a really late start. But I watched Juno Dance Unlimited's Nutcracker 1 year, and I thought it looked really, really fun. And so the next year, one of my I was taking a modern dance class at JDT, and Kaylee Neary said, oh, you should try ballet if you like. And I thought, oh, I'll give it a shot. So I started that fall and really just fell in love with it and all the hard work.
And what would you say that you're picking up from the Bolshoi Ballet that you wouldn't have gotten here?
So much of the Russian training, it's really different from what you get in the U.S. They're very precise, very strict about how every movement should be done. They really, really teach you from even just the smallest movement of your head. It's all very, very in the Russian Vaganova style, which is what I really love. You might wonder, why couldn't you just go somewhere in the U.S. and get good training? And there is, but it's all, most of it is very Balanchine style oriented. There's different techniques, and the technique that I really love is Vaganova. So going to Moscow was really the best place in the world for me to be for that technique.
And what keeps drawing you back to ballet?
The way it makes me feel, honestly. I never get tired of watching ballet. I'll dance from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and then go back to my room and watch a ballet. It's so much a part of life. It's so beautiful. And for me, having something that I can work on every single day so hard. And the thing is that in ballet, you do the same movements every day in your technique class. You always start with plié and bar and then move on to center, slowly warming up. And even the professionals, you're doing the same steps that you do when you were 7 years old. It's just you're never stop working. You're always working towards this perfection, and that's really special.
What did you find in Russia that you found also here? I mean, is there McDonald's over there?
There is, unfortunately.
There is. Okay.
I don't go there.
Agreed.
But, yeah. And there's also, I mean, I was actually very surprised the first time I went to Moscow that there is there's much Westernization. There's signs in English, and it's really becoming a very multicultural city. So that's really interesting to experience, too, because there's many in the academy, too. There's many international students in the dorm, and so we really have a very international community. You'll be sitting at a lunch table with someone from Poland, someone from China, someone from Russia, all speaking these different languages, and it's just an amazing experience.
And just building on that, would you say that the Westernization, is the music the same over there, or are they more classical-oriented, or how does that work?
As far as just
like what people listen to, I mean, I'm sure that they've got iPods and stuff like that,
course,
too, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. You know, they listen to a lot of the same music that we do. It just depends where you are. But my host sister loved One Direction when I went over there last summer, and that was just very kind of funny to see that we're just all so similar.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your fundraising event that's coming up. So let's highlight that, because that's why you're here.
Yes.
And why don't you tell everybody about the event, where it's going to be, and what you're going to be doing.
So it'll be this Thursday, August 14th at the Jack from 6 to 8 p.m. Starting at 6:30, I'll give a short presentation with photos from the Academy, some videos of my dancing. I'll be able to answer many questions. There'll be a Q&A period afterwards. There's also a silent and dessert auction. And I want to shout out to all the businesses who have donated and people who are baking, because we're really just so thankful for all their support. It's really amazing.
Go ahead and acknowledge them where they're due here. Go ahead and tell us who's sponsoring.
You. Well, I mean, so far we've had many donations from individuals, Cycle Alaska, Annie Kales, so many people, and I will be compiling a list and putting it up at the event so that everyone can see just how much incredible support this town has given me. I'm so, so thankful.
All right, Mari, and for more information, where can people go to?
They can visit, they can go online on Facebook. There's an event, it's called An Evening with Mari New, Ballerina in Training at the Bolshoi Ballet Academy. You can also follow me on Instagram at Mari New, MairieNew. And really, I hope that it's free. It's a free event. It's open to all ages. It should be. There's something for everyone, I think. And so I'd love to see everyone there.
Okay. Mari New, best of luck with your ballet career.
Thank you.
And best of luck with your little fundraiser that's coming up. So everybody, please help Mari continue her training with the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. And I wish you all the luck in the world. And
thanks
for being our guest on the show.
Thank you so much.
Tonight on 360 North at 8 o'clock, explore the Tongass National Forest on Shades of Green. This week's Native Report is at 8:30. At 9, the Sustainable Northern Shelter Program visits Anaktuvuk Pass with cold climate building techniques. At 10, the documentary Ann Braden, Southern Patriot, remembers an American civil rights leader who mentored three generations of social justice activists. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
This is Bird Note. This bird sound vividly evokes a warm summer evening. It's the flight call of the common nighthawk. Loping overhead with its long, slender wings at dusk, the nighthawk chases down aerial insects with sudden, choppy shifts of direction. Not really a hawk at all, the common nighthawk is closely related to the more fully nocturnal nightjars, such as the whippoorwill of eastern North America. Nighthawks and nightjars have short bills but very wide opening mouths, with which they seem to vacuum up their insect prey. Common nighthawks travel here from Brazil and other South American countries, where they winter. They arrive with remarkable precision from these monumental journeys. Their dark bodies are robin-sized, but they have much longer wings, like two dark boomerangs propelling their erratic flight. Watch for the common nighthawk overhead just after sunset, or better yet, listen for them. With luck, you may witness the male's territorial display as it dives sharply toward the earth, only to pull up at the last second, while the air rushes through its wing feathers, creating a startling wallop of sound. Come to birdnote.org for more about the common nighthawk. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
PM, you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. This is a Juneau afternoon. I'm Ken Fix, your host, and my next guest is Student Services Director Bridget Weiss, and she's here to talk about back-to-school immunizations. Hi, Bridget. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ken.
All right, and tell us a little bit about the immunizations that will be taking place. What are we immunizing for?
Well, there are a variety of immunizations depending on age. Those immunizations are state required, so most students will have those taken care of, but certainly students who are just entering our system or are transferring into our system have to have evidence of those immunizations. If students need immunizations, then on August 16th at the Nugget Mall, there will be a immunization clinic put on by the Juneau Public Health Center between 10 and 2. And that's a great opportunity for families who might need support getting those immunizations.
All right. Which things are we immunizing for?
Again, it's very dependent on age. There are a variety. Tetanus. There's a whole list, so I don't want to be too specific because somebody will have the wrong message for the wrong age. But there is great information on the website related to that, and we are limited on receiving students into our system if they don't have their immunizations. So we are audited by the state for that, so it's really important that families get that taken care of before school starts.
All right, and you grew up here in Juneau.
Yep, I did.
All right, and you were most recently principal at North Pole High School.
I was born and raised here. Actually, I'm a third-generation Juneau graduate, and I left here to go to school in Spokane, Washington after I graduated, and was in Spokane, Washington for 26 years as an educator. And my last 4 years at North Pole High School, I had a great time being a patriot and supporting that school in many ways before finding my way back here to Juneau.
All right, and now you're just the director of student services. What does that entail besides immunizations?
That is a great question. The director of student services has a pretty large umbrella. Probably the largest chunk of my job is supporting our special ed department and our students who we serve through the special ed education programs in the district. We have just around 900 students who receive services for a variety of reasons who need extra support. So my responsibility is supporting those teachers, those paraprofessionals, those families that have needs. And so that's a big chunk. I also support nurses, our nurse and wellness program, thus the immunization piece here before school gets started. I support all counselors in the district, K-12, all of our counselors. I also supervise and manage our homeless grant, or students in transition. We refer to that. It's a federal McKinney-Vento student assistance program for students who are for some reason outside of their regular home living arrangement. And we have lots of resources to support those kids. If anyone knows of students who have those needs, we can get school supplies, we can get backpacks, we can get them transportation if they need to and from school. So they simply need to alert a counselor in their school building if they think they have a student that might qualify for those supports. And that's a really important resource that we have.
And is there anything else that you handle as Director of Student Services?
Well, other support, student support systems like what we call a 504, which is a student who doesn't necessarily qualify for special education, but they need some sort of assistance, usually due to some medical situation. It sometimes is even temporary, and we need to find ways to accommodate that student's learning. And so that's another area that I support. One of the important things coming up as well is our early learning fair, and that is held at Harborview Elementary on September 4th from 4 to 7. And that is a great opportunity for families who have kids under the age of 5. There are a whole lot of community resources that will be present. We will be there as well as the Juneau School District. If, for instance, a parent has a feeling that their child might have some developmental needs, we can do some screenings there and help them determine if they might need some extra support or not. There's door prizes. It's a very fun event. So that's at Harborview Elementary on September 4th in the evening from 4 to 7.
All right, Bridget. And can you tell everybody the website that they can go to so they can specifically target what they're going to need as far as immunizations for what age groups?
If they will go to junoschools.org, then there will be some information there regarding immunizations. The main school district website will have immunization information on it.
Okay, Bridget Weiss, Director of Student Services, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you very much.
It's a little bit of Steely Dan with My Old School. Wow, it's school time again all over. Wow, that's unbelievable. All right, the forecast for today, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, highs in the low 60s with light winds. Tonight, increasing clouds, slight chance of rain in the evening, patchy fog late with lows in the low 50s and light winds. Tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning, rain likely, mainly in the afternoon with highs in the low 60s and light winds becoming southeasterly at 10 miles an hour in the afternoon. This is KTOO in Juneau, and this has been a Juneau afternoon for Tuesday, August 12th. We brought broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay areas, you can tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens in to us at K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet, Nicey Strait, you can hear us on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can get us on GCI Cable Digital Channel 871. Talk to you later, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
I saw old men clambering through the helicopter door, crushing children beneath them.